What happens when the president of the world's strongest country becomes the outlaw? Marjorie Cohn, president of the National Lawyers Guild, shows how George W. Bush has violated both American and international laws repeatedly. The speech was recorded in Vancouver, Canada on February 24, 2008. Her new book is Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law.
First of all, I just want to say by way of disclaimer, people say to me, well, why did you just limit your book to six ways that the Bush gang has defied the law? And the reason I call them a gang is because they act like a gang. I could have gone into many more instances of law breaking by the Bush administration, but I wanted a book that was affordable, that was small enough that people could carry around, people could use for talking points. And if I were to detail all of the law-breaking by the Bush gang, it would be something akin to Webster's Unabridged Dictionary. It wouldn't be affordable. No one could carry it around. So I had to limit it to what I thought were the six most egregious forms of law-breaking by the Bush administration. Now, many of you probably know that at Nuremberg, after World War II, for the first time, individuals were held criminally liable for the most serious crimes, genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and the crime of aggression. The crime of aggression, according to the Nuremberg Tribunal, was considered the supreme international crime because it contained within itself all of the other crimes. The United States is prosecuting a war of aggression against the people of Iraq. A war of aggression is a crime against peace as defined by the United Nations Charter. The UN Charter is part of U.S. law, notwithstanding George W. Bush's distaste for international law. Treaties that we ratify, when I say we, I mean the United States government, which I do not claim to be part of, but treaties that the United States ratifies become part of U.S. law under the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution. And the UN Charter specifies that no country shall use armed force against another country except in two instances, one in self-defense and the other when the Security Council gives its blessing. Neither of those things was present before the United States invaded Iraq in so-called Operation Iraqi Freedom. Now it turns out that the Center for Public Integrity and the Fund for Independence and Journalism have documented 935 lies that the Bush administration made in the 2 years following the September 11th attacks. 935 lies about alleged weapons of mass destruction alleged weapons of mass destruction possessed by Saddam Hussein and alleged ties between Al Qaeda and Iraq. And the study concluded was that the statements were part of an orchestrated campaign that effectively galvanized public opinion and, in the process, led the nation to war under decidedly false pretenses. If you would like to look at these statements, they're at publicintegrity.org. And the chief culprits were George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, then National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of State Colin Powell, Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, and White House Press Secretaries Ari Fleischer and Scott McClellan. So this is how, and I document this in my book as well, the Bush administration convinced the American people and indeed the Congress that Iraq presented a danger to us. The CIA was coming out with intelligence reports saying that Iraq was not a danger. Yet Dick Cheney went across the street to the CIA and continually pressured the CIA to come up with intelligence that would support a policy that had been decided upon long before September 11th. September 11th was the catalyst that allowed the Bush administration to put into effect this campaign to change Saddam Hussein, to oust Saddam Hussein and change the regime. Now, if Saddam Hussein had been amenable to corporate foreign investment in that country and given oil companies sweet deals and allowed us to put our bases there, he would still be the president of Iraq today. But he was resistant, and I'm not defending Saddam Hussein. He was not a great guy, but he did not pose a threat to the United States or any other country. He had not invaded any country in the last 12 years since Kuwait, and his military capacity had been effectively neutered by the Gulf War, by the decade of punishing sanctions under the Clinton regime, and the nearly daily bombings in the so-called no-fly zones. He was not a threat. The Bush administration knew he was not a threat, and yet they continued with their rhetoric about the mushroom cloud, the weapons of mass destruction, al-Qaeda getting a hold of these weapons, and finally led us into war. So there was not an imminent threat that justified self-defense. The other exception, which I mentioned, to the prohibition on the use of force in the UN Charter is when the Security Council agrees. The Bush administration went to the Security Council and got a resolution, 1441, which set up a regime of weapons inspections and talked about breaches of the weapons inspections agreements, but reserved to the Security Council itself the enforcement power, so that if Iraq was out of compliance with Resolution 1441, it was up to the Security Council, not to the United States or any other country, to enforce those resolutions. Bush knew that 1441 did not authorize the use of force. And in fact, three of the permanent members of the Security Council, France, Russia, and China, issued a statement saying that 1441 excludes automaticity in not allowing any country to enforce this resolution if Iraq was out of compliance. So Bush went back to the Security Council to try to get another resolution. And the Security Council said no, wouldn't give him another resolution. So he said, well, we don't really need another resolution anyway. We have these old resolutions left over from the Gulf War, 687, 678, and they will allow us, they plus 1441, will allow us to go into Iraq and change the regime. But none of those resolutions, individually or collectively, justified or authorized Bush and the UK to go into Iraq and change its regime. One of those resolutions gave the United States the ability to use force only to oust Saddam Hussein from Kuwait. Once that was accomplished, the license ended. The other resolution set up a weapons inspections regime. Once again, only the Security Council had the authority to enforce that resolution. So no self-defense and no authorization from the Security Council, which makes it a crime against peace, a war of aggression. What were the real reasons to go into Iraq? Well, I think that a clue to the real reasons can be found. Actually, three different things can be pointed to show the real reason that the United States went in and changed the regime. First of all, the huge mega military bases that Bush is building there, they're like small self-contained cities. Camp Anaconda, which is the largest embassy in the world, which is opening in the fall, sits on 15 square miles of Iraqi soil. It has a pool, a gym, a theater, a beauty salon, a school, six apartment buildings. Actually, that's a Camp Anaconda. The embassy is a $6 million embassy in the green zone. So these are the bases that are built there. And then there's the so-called Iraqi oil law, which has been the benchmark to gauge Iraqi progress, according to Bush, according to the U.S. Congress, according to the Iraq Study Group, according to the New York Times. The Iraqi oil law, which was written largely by the Bush administration, would turn over control of three-quarters of Iraq's oil to foreign oil companies. Okay. And then, most recently, Bush has been negotiating a permanent military presence, U.S. military presence, in Iraq to effectively tie the hands of whoever the next president is. His outline for the permanent U.S.-Iraqi economic relationship is to encourage the flow of foreign investments to Iraq, unquote. Two senior Iraqi officials told the Associated Press that Bush is negotiating preferential treatment for U.S. investments. And this is in the absence of this Iraqi oil law. The reason that the Iraqi oil law has not become law is because the parliament has not passed it, the Iraqi parliament, and that's because the Iraqi oil unions oppose it. But Bush is going around them and negotiating with his handpicked people in the government in Iraq to try to make sure that there's this permanent military presence. Now, Congress, and you probably, if you have been following the events in the United States, which I know many of you have, Congress has not, neither the Republican-controlled or the Democratic-controlled Congress, has been very good at standing up to Bush's pressure. Bush waves the flag of the 9/11 tragedy, the September 11th tragedy, and says, if you don't do what I say, if you don't give me the Patriot Act, the authorization for the Iraq War, the Military Commissions Act, the so-called Protect America Act, you're going to look soft on terror and the terrorists are going to get us. And Congress has capitulated, although Congress is starting to stand up to him, and I'm going to get to that when I get to the spying, the surveillance. So Congress, there is some movement now in Congress to prevent this permanent military security relationship that Bush is negotiating. It comes down to whether or not it's a treaty, and if it constitutes a treaty, then the Senate has to ratify the treaty under the Constitution, but that is now in flux. What has been the result of this operation, so-called Iraqi Freedom? Well, in addition to the more than 4,000 U.S. troops and troops from other countries that have died, and many mercenaries as well, and they don't give us figures on that, the organization called Just Foreign Policy has estimated that 1,118,846 Iraqis have been killed. Now, this does not include the tens of thousands, the innumerable number of people who have been wounded, many of them with brain injuries, loss of limbs, and the money that has gone into this war is just phenomenal. So much so that the United States is on the verge of a recession. The Australian-born journalist John Pilger wrote, "The scale of death caused by the British and U.S. governments may well have surpassed that of the Rwanda genocide, making it the biggest single act of mass murder in the late 20th century and the 21st century." Well, in order to facilitate this policy of regime change, which also violates another treaty that the United States has ratified, Canada has as well, and that's the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which forbids forcible regime change. The United States government has engaged in torture and cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment of prisoners in U.S. custody in Iraq, in Afghanistan, at Guantanamo Bay base, and in the CIA, secret CIA black sites around the world. Torture is illegal under the Convention Against Torture and other cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. It's always illegal, even in times of war. There are no exceptions. It also violates the Geneva Conventions. It constitutes a war crime under the U.S. War Crimes Act, and it also violates the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And yet, the United States has been engaged in torture and cruel treatment all over the world. Michael Mukasey, the latest attorney general, the third attorney general, who was brought in because Alberto Gonzalez had a bad memory, couldn't remember 70 times when the Senate asked him about the U.S. attorney firing scandal, which is a whole other issue. Michael Mukasey was brought in, a former federal judge, and he was going to be independent. And of course, Michael Mukasey has goose-stepped to the Bush agenda consistently since he he was confirmed. Michael Mukasey refuses to say whether waterboarding constitutes torture. Waterboarding is an ancient torture technique where the prisoner is tied to a slant board with his head slanted down, his face is covered with a cloth, and then water is poured into his nose and mouth until he bursts, drowns, or feels like he's about to drown. It is an excruciatingly painful torture technique, and it's widely regarded as torture. In fact, retired Navy Rear Admiral John Hudson testified at Mukasey's confirmation hearing that aside from the rack and thumb screws, waterboarding is perhaps the most iconic form of torture. It goes back to the Spanish Inquisition. Now, why does Michael Mukasey refuse to say that waterboarding is torture? For two reasons. First of all, the U.S. War Crimes Act punishes torture as a war crime, and commanders all the way up the chain of command to the commander-in-chief can be liable for war crimes if they knew or should have known their subordinates would be committing them and they did nothing to stop or prevent it. That's a principle from Nuremberg, and it's also enshrined in U.S. law. The Bush government, has admitted waterboarding at least three prisoners, and the torture memos, which came from the Bush administration from people like John Yoo, David Addington, Jay Bybee, narrowly defined torture so that it actually violated torture. You had to practically kill someone or seriously cause organ damage or failure in order to constitute torture, in violation of the definition of torture in the Convention Against Torture. So the torture memos constitute a common plan and a conspiracy, really, on the part of the people in the Department of Justice to violate the Geneva Conventions and the Convention Against Torture. Lawrence Wilkerson, the former chief of staff to Colin Powell when Colin Powell was Secretary of State, said on National Public Radio that the policies resulting in the torture and abuse of prisoners emanated from the vice president's office. So if Michael Mukasey were to admit that waterboarding was torture, knowing that torture violates the U.S. War Crimes Act, he would be calling at least Dick Cheney and perhaps George W. Bush as well, since a lot of the memos originated from Bush's office, war criminals. The second reason that Mukasey refuses to say that waterboarding is torture is because under the Military Commissions Act, which governs the military commissions, which are our criminal courts at Guantanamo to try people for war crimes, evidence obtained by torture is not admissible. But evidence obtained by cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment is admissible, assuming that it took place, that this cruel treatment took place before December of 2005. So if these, and I'm going to get in a minute, I'm going to get to the people who are going to be tried in these military commissions. First, three, lower level people, and now the six alleged al-Qaeda leaders who have some connection allegedly with 9/11, September 11th. If evidence against these people in the military commissions was obtained by torturing or waterboarding other prisoners, then it could not be used. So these are the two reasons that Mukasey refuses to admit what everyone else knows, which is that waterboarding is torture. And one other thing that I want to say is that even if torture were not illegal, it doesn't work. People who are tortured will say anything to get the torture to stop. And in fact, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is one of the six men who is currently facing trial in the military commissions, and Abu Zubaydah, who was one of the men that was waterboarded, both of them were waterboarded, admitted to al-Qaeda targeting just about every building in the world under this waterboarding and torture. So their information is virtually worthless. Here are two perhaps potentially very rich sources of intelligence who have been destroyed by the torture. Now, I want to say a few words about the military commission's trials. And there haven't really been any trials yet under the military commissions. The first three men who were charged, I should say men and boy, who were charged under the military commissions were David Hicks, Salim Ahmed Hamdan, and Omar Khadr, a Canadian citizen and a child. David Hicks was such a dangerous terrorist that he was allowed to plead guilty and got what amounted to a misdemeanor sentence, 8 months, and was sent to Australia to serve out his term. What was the condition? The condition was that he keep quiet about the torture that he suffered. He says that he was tortured, that he was sodomized in custody. So the condition of him being able to go back to Australia, serve out these few months, was that he not talk about the mistreatment that he suffered, that he not talk to the media, and that he not file a lawsuit. Very similar to the conditions under which John Walker Lind, the so-called American Taliban, who was caught in Afghanistan, was allowed to plead guilty to lesser charges as long as he did not talk about the mistreatment that he suffered. This was the first indication that the Bush administration was going to torture and then cover it up. I don't know how many of you see CNN, but there were pictures, video pictures of John Walker Lind strapped to a board, naked, writhing in pain from a bullet left in his thigh, and he was allowed to plead guilty to lesser charges. So that was David Hicks. The second, Hamdan, was allegedly Osama bin Laden's driver, and his case went all the way up to the Supreme Court of the United States. And in the Hamdan case, the Supreme Court said that the original Military Commissions Act, which governs these trials at Guantanamo that Bush and Rumsfeld had come up with in November of 2001, were unconstitutional because they denied due process in violation of the Geneva Conventions and the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So Bush went back to the drawing board and rammed through Congress the new Military Commissions Act. And the new Military Commissions Act is not much better. Not only does it allow cruel evidence obtained from cruel and inhuman treatment if it happened before December of 2005, but it allows a trial to continue without the presence of the accused, and it's a basic tenet of international law and other laws of other countries, such as the United States and Canada, that believe in due process and fair trials, that the trial is held before a neutral, independent decision maker, be that a jury or a judge. What the Military Commissions Act does is to allow the Secretary of Defense to appoint the judges. So already it's fixed. It permits the introduction of hearsay evidence obtained without a warrant, and it denies the accused the right to see all the evidence against him. Defense attorneys are not allowed to meet with their clients in private. Everything that they talk about with their clients is overheard by the government. And the defense attorneys have to turn over all their notes to the Bush administration. These are the military commissions. And I want to say one other thing that just came out recently that's quite interesting. Since the Bush administration knows that it is not allowed under the Military Commissions Act to introduce evidence that was secured by torture, what they have done is the Department of Justice and the Pentagon have instituted an extensive program to re-interview the same prisoners who have been tortured and subjected to abusive treatment, this time with clean teams. So, for example, let's say a prisoner implicated one of the defendants, one of these six defendants who's going to appear before the military commissions, during an interrogation using waterboarding. And the government is now going to re-interrogate those prisoners without the waterboarding and get the same information and then say, well, we secured that information humanely. It's a farce and a sham, but that's what they're doing. At least hundreds of hours of videotapes of interrogations of at least two prisoners have been destroyed. The CIA destroyed them, and that's another. There are several scandals. In fact, it's hard to keep up with all the scandals. It's a full-time job, I find. Every time you open the paper or turn on the television, there's another scandal. And one of the scandals was that the CIA destroyed all of these tapes, possibly exonerating evidence, which violates U.S. law. The defendant has a right to any evidence that might exonerate him. And one of the people whose interrogations was videotaped and they were destroyed is a man named Abu Zubaydah. Abu Zubaydah was thought to be the number three man in al-Qaeda. And in fact, he was a very he really knew almost nothing about the operations of al-Qaeda. According to Dan Coleman, one of the FBI's leading counterterrorism experts, Abu Zubaydah was schizophrenic. Abu Zubaydah had this very serious mental illness and was not at all privy to these high-level conversations. Abu Zubaydah was waterboarded. His medication was withheld. He was subjected to extreme temperatures. He was tortured. He was subjected to cruel treatment. Abu Zubaydah, according to the Bush administration, led them to colleague Sheikh Mohammed, although that's a matter of dispute whether he actually did that or not. So these videotapes of Abu Zubaydah's interrogations might possibly, if they still existed, provide exonerating evidence for colleague Sheikh Mohammed, and yet they've been destroyed. A study which was just completed by the Seton Hall Law Center for Policy and Research reveals that more than 25,000 interrogations have been conducted at Guantanamo since 2002, and every interrogation was videotaped. Many of these interrogations were abusive, and the report says that, and it relies on government documents almost exclusively, detainee treatment was so violent as to shake the camera in the interrogation room and cause severe internal injury. These are some of the interrogations that were videotaped. Now, is there any possibility that the military commission's procedures and this torture and these torturous interrogations are going to be reviewed by the Supreme Court and there's going to be any relief? Well, not if Justice Antonin Scalia has his way. You've all heard of Scalia. Scalia has already said that interrogations conducted through the use of torture are not unconstitutional, which means that he has prejudged the issues in future cases that might come before him, which is why the National Lawyers Guild, my organization, has issued a press release calling for Justice Scalia to recuse himself or step down from any of these cases that might come to him, come before him, regarding the constitutionality of these interrogations. Now, you might have heard that John McCain is running for president. John McCain is probably going to be the Republican nominee for president, at least it looks that way. He was the POW, prisoner of war, who was tortured in Vietnam. And to his credit, he has stood up in the past to torture and was very instrumental in the Detainee Treatment Act, which outlawed cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. It actually just codified existing law. And at that time, in 2005, toward the end of 2005, Dick Cheney went to John McCain and said, listen, can we have an exemption from the CIA so the CIA can use cruel treatment? John McCain said, nothing doing. No, can't do it. Although it turns out that the Detainee Treatment Act has an exception in it that's big enough to drive a truck through. But nevertheless, John McCain has said waterboarding is torture. He's consistently been against torture. Now we have presidential candidate John McCain, and John McCain voted against the congressional resolution to outlaw cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment by the CIA. So now that he is a presidential candidate, he's trying his best to consolidate the right wing of the Republican Party. He's decided that it's okay for the CIA to use cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. One of the more egregious flip-flops by candidate John McCain. Okay, well, let's talk about the third defendant, Omar Khadr, Canadian citizen, who is facing charges of conspiracy, murder, attempted murder, spying, and supporting terrorism. Omar Khadr was captured in Afghanistan and brought to Guantanamo when he was 15 years old. In both places, he was repeatedly tortured and subjected to inhumane treatment. At the Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, Omar Khadr was denied pain medication for his serious head and eye shrapnel wounds. At Guantanamo, his hands and feet were shackled together. He was bolted to the floor and left there for hours at a time. After he urinated on himself and on the floor, U.S. military guards mopped the floor with his skinny little body. Cotter was beaten in the head, dogs lunged at him, and he was threatened with rape and removal of his body parts. Omar cried frequently. He has nightmares, sweats, and hyperventilates, and he's hypervigilant, hearing sounds that he can't identify. When Omar's lawyer saw him for the first time in 2004, he thought, he's just a little kid. Why was Omar treated this way? He comes from a family allegedly active in Al-Qaeda. His charges stem from an incident where the U.S. sent Afghans into a compound where Omar and others were located. The people inside the compound killed the Afghans and began firing at the U.S. soldiers. The Americans dropped two 500-pound bombs on the compound, killing everyone inside except Omar. After Omar threw a hand grenade, which killed an American, the soldiers shot Omar, blinding and seriously wounding him. Omar begged them in English to finish him off, but they didn't. They took him to Bagram Air Base and later to Guantanamo. According to Donald Reckoff, who was the co-chair of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers Military Law Committee, Omar is in an unusual situation because he has a viable self-defense claim. This is what the lawyer says. We attacked the compound that he and his family were living in and the fact that he was only 15 at the time. If Omar were a U.S. citizen, he would not be subject to a trial by court-martial because of his, he would not even be subject to a trial by court-martial because of his age. He would be tried in the civilian courts. When the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 2005 in the case of Roper versus Simmons that children who were under 18 at the time of their crimes could not be executed, and the U.S. is the only Western democracy that still retains the death penalty, which is also a penalty that is available and being charged against these six alleged al-Qaeda members at Guantanamo. The Supreme Court said that youths display a lack of maturity and an underdeveloped sense of responsibility that often results in impetuous and ill-considered actions and decisions. A juvenile is more vulnerable or susceptible to negative influences, and his character is not as well formed as that of an adult. From a moral standpoint, Supreme Court Justice Kennedy wrote for the majority, it would be misguided to equate the failings of a minor with those of an adult. For a greater possibility exists that a minor's character deficiencies will be reformed. The Bush administration's treatment of Omar Khadr, a Canadian citizen, flies in the face of this Supreme Court opinion. Now, the six men who are charged at Guantanamo are charged with the death penalty. And the timing of these trials, after all these years of being held in the CIA black sites, tortured, and then brought to Guantanamo, the timing is very fortuitous, I think, because it's another way for the Bush administration to keep foremost in the minds of the American public, the so-called war on terror. And when I say that, I'm not trying to minimize what happened on September 11th or what's happening in the world, but declaring war on a tactic, because terrorism is a tactic, which then allows you to continue to hold people forever without any resort to any kind of independent decision maker, is illegal. Every major international criminal tribunal since Nuremberg, which includes the International Criminal Court, the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia, and the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, are set up to try the most egregious crimes, genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, yet none of them allow for the death penalty. But here in these kangaroo courts, in these military commissions at Guantanamo, the Bush administration, with hand-picked judges, are going to try people and possibly execute them, even though the death penalty is not available in these other criminal tribunals or even in other Western democracies. First of all, the Military Commissions Act, one of the other things that it does, aside from setting up these new and improved rules for these kangaroo courts, is to strip the Guantanamo prisoners of any habeas corpus rights. And many of you I know that habeas corpus goes back to the Magna Carta. It's a critical, critical procedure where people who are being held in custody can go before a neutral judge and convince that judge or try to convince that judge that they're being unlawfully held. At every step of the way, the Bush administration has resisted allowing these detainees at Guantanamo the right to habeas corpus. And the Military Commissions Act purports to strip them from habeas corpus rights. The Bush administration had argued that by setting up this prison at Guantanamo, the U.S. courts had no jurisdiction because Guantanamo was part of Cuba. U.S. Supreme Court didn't agree. And in Rasul versus Bush a few years ago, the Supreme Court says that, well, maybe it's on Cuban soil, but the U.S. exercises complete jurisdiction and control over the Guantanamo Bay base, and therefore these prisoners have the right to habeas corpus under the habeas corpus statute. Later, in the Military Commissions Act, Congress amended the habeas corpus statute to strip these Guantanamo detainees of any habeas corpus rights. The case that's now pending before the U.S. Supreme Court, two cases, Bumi Dien and Al Oda, test whether or not these Guantanamo detainees still retain a constitutional right to habeas corpus. There is in the U.S. Constitution what is called the suspension clause, which says that habeas corpus shall not be suspended except in times of rebellion or invasion when the public safety may require it. And no one is saying that we're now under rebellion or invasion. Judging from the oral arguments before the Supreme Court, I don't think the majority is going to have a problem finding that these detainees retain the right to habeas corpus. The question is going to become whether or not there's an adequate substitute for habeas corpus. And the Bush administration is saying we have this adequate substitute. It's called the Combatant Status Review Tribunals. Combatant Status Review Tribunals, unlike the military commissions, which try people for crimes, the Combatant Status Review Tribunals are set up to decide whether somebody is an enemy combatant. They are even worse, kangaroo courts, than the military commissions. There's no right to a lawyer. There's only a right to a personal representative. And the personal representative can tell the government everything the detainee tells him. In fact, some of the personal representatives argue the government's case. The detainee doesn't have a right to produce evidence or witnesses. And in the handful of cases where these combatant status review tribunals have determined that someone is not an enemy combatant, the U.S. military has said, go back and do it again and again and again until you find that they are. This, if this were a criminal procedure, this would be double jeopardy, which is why U.S. Constitution has a prohibition against double jeopardy. So the question is whether the appellate review of these combatant status review tribunals constitutes an adequate substitute for habeas corpus. The problem is that the appellate review in U.S. courts of these decisions of the Combatant Status Review Tribunal are limited to determining whether or not these Combatant Status Review Tribunals complied with their own defective procedures. There's no opportunity for these appellate courts to actually look at a case and say, this guy is being mistakenly held. 34 of these, the majority of the 34 plaintiffs in these Bumi Dien and Al Oda cases are people who were picked up by warlords or the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan and Pakistan and sold to the U.S. military for $5,000 a head as bounty. Nothing to do with terrorism at all. And yet the Bush administration continues to insist that they're not entitled to habeas corpus. Now, many of the people at Guantanamo feel hopeless. They've been there like animals in small cages for years and years and years with no hope of ever being released. And so the only power they have is to stop eating. And some 200 of them have engaged in hunger strikes. Well, it's very embarrassing for people in the Bush administration's custody to die. In fact, three already have. One hung himself and two hoarded some medications and killed themselves that way. So what the Bush administration does, the U.S. military, is to force feed them. and it's going to get a little graphic, and I warn you. They strap them down. One guard pulls their head back and sticks into their nose a thick plastic tube into their nose and down into their stomach, which the U.S. Human Rights Commission described as torture. It's excruciatingly painful, especially when they take it out and put it back in. There's no anesthesia, and there's no sterilization of these tubes, so that when you see that tube coming into your nose, you can see the blood and the bile from the prior prisoner on that tube as it comes into your nose. That is torture. That's what the U.S. government is doing at Guantanamo Bay. It's an absolute outrage. It's an outrage what's happening. So this is what's happening. We'll see if anything changes in terms of these policies if and when a Democratic president is elected in November. One would only hope that things would change. U.S. troops in Iraq have been acting under rules of engagement, very much like they did during Vietnam, like free fire zones where you shoot at everything that moves, which means that civilians are targeted. And this was especially true in Fallujah, where in retaliation against the killing and mutilation of four Blackwater mercenaries, the U.S. Military killed 4,000 to 6,000 civilians. There are reports from independent journalists of helicopters firing at families as they're crossing the river, of snipers killing people, of them going in and just killing people, whoever was left in their homes. This is collective punishment. This violates the Geneva Conventions. Civilians have been killed during the shock and awe, you'll recall, which started Operation so-called Iraqi Freedom. Big, huge bombs dropped in civilian areas, targeting civilians, also illegal, constitutes war crimes. In addition, the Bush administration has been engaging in targeted assassinations, which have been illegal since the Gerald Ford administration, but Bush, in 2001, signed a secret executive order rescinding that policy and saying we're going to engage in assassinations. So manned CIA drones took out people, suspected al-Qaeda, in Yemen, in Somalia twice, and now in Pakistan. Although, after this election in Pakistan, where the anti-Musharraf forces have prevailed, it may be difficult for Bush to continue to have this arrangement where Musharraf was letting the CIA, these unmanned drones, take out people. Forget about giving them a fair trial. Forget about the presumption of innocence. Forget about due process. Forget about the fact that we may get the wrong guys, or maybe get some women and children, or maybe some civilians along with it. But when this happens, Yemen, Somalia, is barely a blip. I mean, it's barely even covered by the media, and yet this is illegal. This constitutes a war crime. Another violation of the law by the Bush administration has been the secret surveillance. Surveillance not just of people who are suspected terrorists, but also of Americans and also of people who dissent against the administration's policies. And this is not a new phenomenon, but the extent to which it's happening is new. And the Bush administration, although certainly former U.S. presidents have engaged in lawbreaking, I can't think of one who rises to the level of the lawbreaking of the Bush administration. So in the 50s and 60s, under J. Edgar Hoover, that infamous FBI director, there was a program called COINTELPRO, Counterintelligence Program, where dissidents or critics of the administration were targeted, people like Martin Luther King Jr., organizations like my own, the National Lawyers Guild, were infiltrated, and there was surveillance conducted. And Richard Nixon spied on his enemies, or his critics. The Congress did a thorough investigation under the jurisdiction of Frank Church, who was a senator from Idaho, and they were so upset that they passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act in 1978, or FISA. A Republican-controlled Congress passed this law, signed by Jimmy Carter, to protect the United States security and at the same time make sure that before wiretapping could take place, which is an incredibly intrusive procedure, that the government would approach judges who were picked by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who met in secret, a very conservative court, and show the administration probable cause why there was foreign intelligence to be gathered and why they should get this wiretapping order. And since 1978, the FISA court has denied less than what would fit on one hand in terms of the number of wiretap orders that the administrations have asked for. But that wasn't good enough for George W. Bush. And so since early 2001, and he was another lying about when it happened. He said, well, we had to get the terrorist after 9/11. It turns out they were doing it 6 months before 9/11. Instituted his so-called terrorist surveillance program to violate FISA, violate the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which protects against unreasonable searches and seizures, and spy on people, including American citizens, without a warrant. And he continued to do that until he's still continuing to do it. The New York Times broke the story. It was a big hoopla. Congress said, oh, this is terrible. And then last August, on the eve of the summer recess, Bush once again rammed through Congress, still in terrorized by his waving the 9/11 flag, the Protect America Act, the so-called Protect America Act, which ostensibly is supposed to fill in a gap that was left by FISA in 1978, because in 1978 they did not foresee that foreign communications would have to pass through internet service providers in the United States. But it went way beyond that. It took the power to make these decisions about wiretapping out of the hands of the judge and put them in the hands of the Attorney General and the Director of National Intelligence, and lowered the standards for wiretapping. But also, quite significantly, it gave immunity to the huge telecommunications companies that are turning over our telephone and computer data to the government. And this is vast amounts of data. That was a six-month, Protect America Act went on for 6 months, although it really is, it gives them for a year. It actually goes on for a year, but it expired on February 1st. So before it was about to expire, Dick Cheney went to the Heritage Foundation, a right-wing think tank, and invoking the memory of September 11th 12 times, told the Heritage Foundation how critical it was to the safety and security of the United States that they make this Protect America Act permanent. And George Bush said, the terrorists are going to get us if you don't make this permanent. Well, the House of Representatives, we have two houses, the House of Representatives and the Senate. The House of Representatives agreed to make it permanent, but said we're not going to give retroactive immunity to these telecommunications companies. And the telecommunications companies are facing more than 40 lawsuits, because that's the only, since we our Congress doesn't think that impeachment, which is in the Constitution for a reason, but doesn't think impeachment is off the table. The only way to hold him accountable for this lawbreaking around this surveillance is these lawsuits by people, including the National Lawyers Guild and other organizations, against the telecommunications companies, which are violating several laws, including FISA, including the Fourth Amendment, the First Amendment. So Bush said, the terrorists are going to get us if you don't make this act permanent. And the Senate went along with him and said, okay, here's the immunity for the telecommunications companies. So Bush came back and he said, I'm going to veto this law unless you give immunity to the telecommunications companies, which means that he thinks that giving immunity to the big corporations is more important than keeping America safe. Well, the House of Representatives, in a singular moment, stood up to the Bush administration, stood up to George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, and said, no, we're not going to give this immunity. Let's have an extension for 2 weeks. And Bush said no. And they called his bluff, and it expired, and he went off to Africa. And that's where we are now. He's back to pressuring them. And the reason he wants this to be permanent before he leaves office is to tie the hands of a future administration to make sure that his friends in the telecommunications companies get this immunity. So stay tuned. Okay, the last instance of lawbreaking by George W. is the signing statements. How many of you have heard of the signing statements? Yeah. The founding fathers, the United States, put into the Constitution three separate co-equal branches of government to check and balance each other so that no one would become all-powerful: the legislative, the executive, and the judiciary. And James Madison, one of the founding fathers, warned that the accumulation of all powers in the same hands is the very definition of tyranny. Well, about more than 200 years later, and let me just back up, the colonists in the United States were reacting against the police state of King George III, the British king. More than 200 years later, we have another King George, King George W. Bush, who seeks to accumulate all governing powers in the same hands, his and Cheney's. And so the U.S. Constitution provides that Congress has the power to make the laws. Once both houses of Congress, the House of Representatives and the Senate, pass a bill, the president has two choices. He can sign it or he can veto it. But Bush opts for a third alternative. He signs the bill. In almost every case, he rarely vetoes a bill. He signs it with great fanfare, and then he quietly attaches what is called a signing statement, saying, I'm not going to follow those parts of it that I don't agree with. Now, other presidents have done this before Bush, but never to the same extent. Bush has attached signing statements to more than 1,100 provisions of law that Congress has passed. I always like to read at least one passage from the book, and this is a good one. Bush likes to talk about how much he supports our troops. He's supporting the troops. We have to support the troops. We have to appropriate more and more money to support the troops. Of course, if he really wanted to support the troops, he'd bring them home from Iraq. But he doesn't want to support them that much. So there are some signing statements that are not well known, and I just want to read you a brief passage and then think to yourself about how much Bush really does support our troops in Iraq. He issued a signing statement scoffing at the limits Congress has placed on the number of days a member of the armed forces may be deployed. Bush has also reserved the right to disobey congressional mandates that the Defense Secretary report to Congress about whether the prohibition against requiring injured troops to pay for their hospital meals is being enforced, and about the effectiveness of detection and diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder. He has likewise signed away his obligation to have his defense secretary institute studies about brain injuries suffered by our troops and mental health benefits for members of the armed forces. That doesn't sound like a president who supports the troops. And there are actually some new signing statements that in the most recent appropriation for the war that Bush has attached. Congress said no permanent U.S. military bases in Iraq. Bush attached a signing statement saying, I'm not going to follow that one. There's one that protects whistleblowers against retaliation when they actually reveal information about what's happening, about corruption in these corporations, which have to do with, for example, the contractors and the mercenaries. He said, I'm not going to follow that one either. And there's another one that provides for accountability to Congress and reporting about what's happening with the contractors. He says, I'm not going to follow that one either. And so it's really, I mean, you hear what's happening, you read about what's happening. It's worse than you think. It's worse than you think. So what is there to do? I mean, now that I've depressed everybody and painted this horrible, bleak picture, we're having this presidential election you've probably heard about, and there's hope that we might have a change, that we might have a Democratic administration. The biggest difference between John McCain on the one hand and Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama on the other is that John McCain says that we're going to stay in Iraq for at least 100 years. Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton say, no, we want to get the troops home. But neither of them want to get all the troops home. They both want to leave some troops there. They talk about being opposed to the bases. We'll see what happens there. There are prosecutions which can be initiated under the War Crimes Act, under the criminal law in the United States. But who brings those prosecutions against these leaders, Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and John Yoo, et cetera? Well, the Attorney General. And the chances of Michael Mukasey bringing any prosecutions against any members of the Bush administration are less than zero. Now, it's possible that in a future administration, the future Attorney General might bring these charges, but that also is highly unlikely. There's the International Criminal Court, the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court, which Canada has ratified, the United States has not. In fact, when Bush came into office in 2002, May of 2002, he took the U.S. signature off the treaty, and then he blackmailed more than 100 countries, mostly developing countries with weak democracies and struggling economies, and said, if you turn over any Americans to the International Criminal Court at The Hague, we are going to punish you. Basically, we're going to withhold foreign aid, etc. And so he has effectively taken, although there are still some ways that they can get jurisdiction, that is not really an effective remedy. Now, there is a doctrine called universal jurisdiction. How many of you have heard of universal jurisdiction? Universal jurisdiction is the doctrine that Israel used to prosecute, to try, convict, and execute Adolf Eichmann for his crimes during the Holocaust, even though they had no direct connection with Israel. Most countries, including Canada, including the United States, have universal jurisdiction statutes, and it goes something like this. Some crimes are so heinous, they're crimes against all of humanity. So any country has the right to bring people to trial if the country of the national, who's the suspect, is unwilling or unable to prosecute. There have been attempts to bring Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld to justice for their crimes in Iraq, for torture in Belgium, in Germany, in France, and in Canada also. And I have to commend Gail Davidson, the woman who introduced me from the Lawyers Against the War, for valiantly bringing a complaint to the Canadian courts, which didn't get very far, but it's possible in the future that it might. And the problem is that when the Bush administration hears about these universal jurisdiction prosecutions, it blackmails these countries. For example, Belgium. There was an action pending in a Belgian court against Rumsfeld, and the Bush administration threatened Belgium that if they didn't change their universal jurisdiction statute and drop the charges against Rumsfeld, because he wouldn't be able to travel and he'd be arrested, they would pull the headquarters of NATO out of Brussels, and so Belgium backed down. The German federal prosecutor, when the charges were first brought to him, said, well, we don't have any indication that the United States government is not going to bring charges against these people. Meanwhile, the Congress passes the Military Commissions Act, and one more horrible thing that it does is to give retroactive immunity to these Bush officials for their war crimes. So then the Center for Constitutional Rights, my group, the National Lawyers Guild, others went back to the German federal prosecutor and said, here's your indication that the U.S. government is not going to bring them to justice. So then, after a time where invariably the Bush administration put pressure on the German government and Angela Merkel, the German federal prosecutor came back and said, well, there's no real connection between these crimes and the German government. Totally misunderstanding what universal jurisdiction is all about. So what does that leave? Well, that leaves we the people. That's really what it's all about. And that means that in my country, in the United States, here in Canada, we have to continue to speak out, to write, to any opportunity we have to demonstrate against these policies. And I know You don't have the same responsibility because your government is not doing the kinds of things that my government is doing. But when you have people like Omar Khadr, who's a Canadian citizen, this child who is being held in Guantanamo and has been subjected to torture, that is an opportunity to actually complain and make your voices heard. So any way that you can, letters to the editor, op-eds, pressure, go on the radio, demonstrate, continue to, and there's a wonderful progressive community of people here in Vancouver. I met with many of them last night, and I'm just so impressed with the level of activity and social conscience in this city. So any way you can, get involved, because we're all citizens of the world, and even though my government deserves the lion's share of blame for what's going on, anything anybody can do is welcome.
That was Marjorie Cohn, author of Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. She is president of the National Lawyers Guild in the United States. The speech was titled George Bush's War on the Rule of Law. So you can find out more at marjoriecohn.com.